ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
It is a truth universally acknowledged that on one's 250th birthday, there should be a celebration. I'm Claire Nichols, and on The Book Show, we're raising our teacups to Jane Austen.
Why Austen? What is it about her?
Authors Colm Tobin, Karen Joy Fowler, and more will explore why, in 2025, the Austen effect is bigger than ever.
It's quite incredible.
Search for The Book Show and look for Dear Jane wherever you get your podcasts, or hear it now on the ABC Listen app.
Hi there, this is David Rutledge. Welcome to the Philosopher's Zone once again. We're doing literary theory this week, which is a field that I got interested in as a wet behind the ears undergraduate many years ago, but that I haven't stayed particularly close to in the years since. Like, I haven't been tracking debates or trends within literary theory. And so it was really interesting to me to come across a recent paper that addressed a question that had fascinated and perplexed me all those years ago as a literature undergrad, and that has really continued to fascinate and perplex me ever since, even if I haven't kept up to date on all of the discourse around it. That question is, what exactly are we doing when we read a text? And that question opens onto the equally fascinating and perplexing question of what is a text in the first place? Because one thing that a text isn't is a receptacle that simply contains meaning in the way that a bottle of milk contains milk. And when you're reading a text, you're not just sort of opening up your head and pouring the meaning from the text into your mind, like milk into a glass. There's something a lot more complex and indeterminate going on. And exploring that complexity and indeterminacy is what's been keeping literary critics in business for all of these years. My guest this week is Audrey Wasser. She's an assistant professor in the Department of French, Italian and Classical Studies at Miami University in Ohio. And her paper, which we'll put a link to on the Philosopher's Zone website, is Empiricism, Criticism and the Object of Criticism. Now, I'm still catching up on recent developments in literary criticism. The last time I looked, literary criticism was still very much under the sway of what's often called the hermeneutics of suspicion, which is this wonderful term coined by the 20th century French philosopher Paul Ricoeur. Tell me about the hermeneutics of suspicion. What does that phrase refer to?
I mean, so as you know, it's a kind of style of analysis common to Marx, Freud, and Nietzsche. I think in more recent years, it's just kind of become suspicious reading. Like Rita Felsky calls it suspicious reading as a way to refer to French theory, actually, surprisingly, not so much to the Germans like Marx, Nietzsche, Freud. And it's kind of a derogatory term because the generation of critics is tired of this mode, of this theoretical mode, and it's kind of looking for different affects, not so suspicious, but more positive, more modes of attachment rather than suspicion.
But how is the suspicion articulated? Like if I say that I'm employing a hermeneutics of suspicion to read this or that particular text, what exactly am I doing?
I think it's a derogatory term, and I'm not really on board with the project of criticizing a hermeneutics of suspicion. So I'm kind of talking through like what do people mean when they say this in a derogatory way? And I think they have in mind a kind of grid reading where you take a theorist's work or a theory and you kind of impose it on a literary text in an overly willful way. And you distort the meaning of the text to find like hidden, you know, some sort of hidden meaning underneath the surface, and that your comportment towards it is suspicious because you think that the truth of it or the meaning of it is not available on the surface. And so you have to kind of dig beneath.
The kind of suspicious reading strategy that I always think of as emblematic is that of Jacques Derrida's deconstructive approach, where he's complicating a certain kind of critical perspective that sees the meaning of the text as a function of the internal consistency of that text. And so, of course, deconstructive reading is a matter of saying, well, hang on a minute, the text is not actually as consistent with itself as it seems. It contains ambiguities and contradictions, and it's possible to mine those contradictions and pull other meanings out of them, read the text against itself. So that's Derrida. And when people take this critical stance against the hermeneutics of suspicion, this is the kind of thing that they're opposing, right?
I'm not sure. And I myself align myself with a deconstructive approach. I was raised by deconstructive thinkers, and I feel very much indebted to that style of reading. What's been going on more recently, but recently is, let's say, the last 20 years or so in the discipline, are all these arguments about method, you know, to the extent that it's been called a method wars, which is exciting, you know, if there's any kind of war at all, I think. But just a lot of discussion about how do we read, right? What is the way that we read now? And that's the title of a special issue that came out in 2009 of the journal Representations. And so in that journal, there was a lot of discussion of something else, a new style of reading that could be called surface reading. And so that there's a lot of conversation that kind of came out of that essay and some related essays that advocated for reading the surface of a text as opposed to plumbing the depths. And so they were against hermeneutics of suspicion, but I don't think they really used that particular phrase. I think they used the phrase symptomatic reading. And the target there was not so much Derrida, but Frederick Jameson and Louis Althusser. And so the target was really a Marxist style of reading that they saw as overly willful and contorting texts to fit a kind of Marxist agenda. Derrida has not come up so explicitly, I think, in these conversations about method. But sure, there is a sense that critics are tired of the days of high theory. And, you know, high theory in Anglophone context means like Derrida and French, you know, the importation of French theory and philosophy into literary arguments.
Right. And this movement away from high theory has been in part a movement in the direction of a more affect-oriented modes of criticism, post-critique being one of them. Tell me about that approach. What does post-critique involve?
Right. And that I associate with Rita Felski, who does talk about suspicious readings and is kind of tired of the bad affects that circulate with that style of reading. So she wants to explore just sort of modes of attachment, positive feelings. And I'm not, you know, tremendously a fan of this style of reading. You know, she and other people in favor of post-critique are frustrated with the negative affects and the kind of one-upmanship that critique can sometimes inspire. They're tired of a kind of mechanical repetition of a certain style of critique that I guess you see like, you know, here's a method and then a bunch of grad students go and apply it. And I personally don't know if that's a legitimate complaint against theory or just the bad application of theory, right?
But what does post-critique pay attention to? I mean, when we talk about it, there's a more affect-oriented mode of criticism. Is this a sort of attention being paid to how texts make us feel? What's going on there?
Yeah, how texts make us feel, what we're attached to, kind of what is the total situation in which we have attachments. So I'm thinking of Rita Felski's book called Hooked, in which she describes like the sort of, yeah, total scene of when she first encountered a song and why she felt attached to it. And there's inspiration there taken from Bruno Latour's actor network theory. So it's not just a accounting for one's personal feelings, but it's more of a broader description of everything that is in the situation, like objects, other people, other affects, if that makes sense.
So is it that the aesthetic force of the text is what matters more than its ideology or its ideological residue?
Yes, I think so. Yeah. Aesthetic effect, aesthetic experience. So maybe you're talking about the reader's experience as opposed to a set of concepts or arguments that the reader would make. Whereas I'm leaning on my own work towards what are the arguments and concepts that the reader makes.
The thing that strikes me here is that while skeptical readings of a text may indeed have a certain, you know, wearyingly predictable negativity about them sometimes, and a more affective approach can be more productive, more charitable to the text and to the author, it also seems radically subjective. Like if I'm writing principally about how a text works on my emotions and my mood and my sensations, how the text connects with me, what's to say that I'm not just doing autobiography and that nobody who reads my work as a critic is going to learn very much about the text under discussion?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think so. And I feel like the question is, how do we build something together with that? And you can talk about your affects, I can talk about my affects, or you can talk about your experience, I talk about my experience. But what are we doing something in common? Are we building something together? Or is this just kind of like a mutual share exercise? right? And I see in the project of theory, but also literary criticism, a project of knowledge, one that is on par with other knowledge discourses and knowledge disciplines in the university, that literary critics are not just having experiences and telling about them, but they are actually building knowledge about a set of important artifacts.
So in these post-critical approaches to interpretation then, do we see the role of the critic being constructed as a passive role or at least a receptive role? You know, the text just sort of works its magic on the reader?
Yeah, I do think that's the case. And in the essay that I published recently called Empiricism, Criticism, and the Object of Criticism, I looked a lot at post-critique and surface reading and the language that these critics are using to construe reading as a passive exercise. And that all these method debates that are about reading, I think, end up obscuring the fact that when we talk about reading, this critic has a reading of a poem, for example. We're actually talking about this critic has constructed an interpretation, right? So I think that there is a covering over of the constructive work that critics are doing.
Well, let's talk about surface reading here, which you mentioned earlier and you mentioned just then. At a glance, surface reading looks precisely like what we were told never to do in our undergraduate literature classes. So tell me about surface reading as a critical strategy and its relation to the idea of deep analysis.
There are things I find appealing about it, even though ultimately I'm not on board with the project. And what's appealing about it is just attention to the language of a text. And this is the most important thing I can get my undergrads to do, is to see what's on the page as opposed to just what is coming from their kind of preconceived, you know, notions. And just the practice of re-describing a text, like that is so useful for the undergraduate classroom. Describe what you see, describe what's going on. But I think that on the whole, the project of surface reading is anti-intellectual. I think it's a disavowal of the work and the labor that goes into engaging with a literary text. That description is this sort of false idea that treats the reader as passive and just merely coming along to describe without disturbing the text, and that the text remains untransformed by the description or by the reading.
Yeah, the text remains untransformed. That's a very interesting point. We'll unpack that a bit in a minute. But proponents of surface reading will say that there's no problem with accepting the claims that a text makes about itself, and that surface reading doesn't have to mean shallow reading. It's more a sort of imminent reading, and that affect often is on the surface. You know, it's often produced through tone and rhythm and gesture rather than through hidden content. That would be the defense, wouldn't it?
Yes, I suppose so. I mean, there should be an accounting for the reader's own position in, you know, institutions, in history, in time and place. And so there's also kind of an intentional refusal to account for the reader's own position. And this comes out of kind of concepts taken from anthropology. So Heather Love's work will talk about thin description as opposed to Clifford Geertz's thick description. So the kind of description that has to take account of the observer. So I don't know. I think that surface reading is a willful kind of cutting off of a lot of relevant contextual information and kind of a disavowal that it's even there.
That's one of the things that interests me about surface reading, the border between surface and depth and how that's determined. I mean, for a surface reading critic, is it the case that if a text is just rich in historical background, then that makes it a less suitable text for surface reading because you don't want to go to that background?
Sure. And then, of course, surface is just a metaphor, right? It's a visual metaphor. I'm not sure that it's appropriate to talking about language in terms of surface or depth either. And what image of the text is constructed there? If we say it has a surface or it has a depth, the image is of a solid object, a three-dimensional object that exists in space that can be, you know, seen or touched. And that's not the nature of the literary object.
On ABC Radio National and ABC Listen, this is The Philosopher's Zone with me, David Rutledge, and I'm talking about literary interpretation and the mysterious business of reading with my guest this week, Audrey Wasser from Miami University in the great state of Ohio, USA. More info on The Philosopher's Zone website. Well, let's talk about reading, because most of us would assume that the business of literary criticism begins with reading and that we all know what it means to read a text. But in your essay, you write about how the term reading in literary critical debates can actually signify two very different things, a passive process and an active one. Very interesting. Can you tell me about that tension?
Yeah, I walk through the sort of passivity and activity dynamic in a few different ways. One is that in all these discussions about method and about the way we read now, there is a received idea that reading is just passive, and that the best we can do is to approach a text in the right way and take it in the right way. So I think that is wrong, that reading is actually active. It's not passive. But then I look at all these debates about the way we read now, what is the best method of reading? And I think that critics say they're talking about reading. They say they're talking about reading. What they really are doing is talking about writing. And I think what's really at stake is how do critics write an interpretation? How do they construct an interpretation? Like, what are critics making? So I think that the use of the word reading is kind of overblown and is disguising the activity of criticism. And then I end up looking at Jonathan Cranick's work, which is his book, Criticism and Truth. I think that's actually a kind of an inverse case where he says critics are writers. And what they do is manipulate or, you know, work with the material of other writers' sentences, and they have their own sentences, and they kind of merge with a very skilled practice of merging other people's sentences with one's own sentences. And I think that there's something... I really loved his book, but I also think there's something wrong in that argument, because if everything is writing, he's glossing over something else, which I would describe as the resistance of the text to being perfectly understood, especially in the form of sentences. That this, here's my deconstructive side, is that a text consists of gaps, contradictions, overdeterminations, and ambiguities, and that we have some apprehension of that that does not get perfectly translated in our writing about the text.
So when Jonathan Cranick says that reading and writing become conflated in the activity of criticism, how does that approach fail to take into account those slips and ambiguities within the text, those overdeterminations and so on that you're talking about?
It could be that there's something not quite working in my own terminology. But in my own terminology, like, number one, I want to say that the critic is active, right? That's really important to me. So I'm calling that activity criticism. Number two, I want to say that within this activity, there is a necessary and built-in failure. And that failure comes in the form of contradictions and gaps in the critical text, in the text that the critic writes. And that failure, I'm giving the name reading. And so I'm coming up with this sort of new role for reading. So what I'm calling reading is nestled inside of the critical process. And it's something that registers the failure of the critical process. And it has to fail, because otherwise it's just the fabrication of the critic. And so the failure is the sign that the critic is bumping up against something that the critic did not invent. And that's what I see missing in Jonathan Cranick's account. There's just this total confidence that a literary text can be paraphrased and that it can be rewritten in logical sentences, and no anxiety about ambiguity or overdetermination or things that cannot be easily translated.
Yeah. We're getting into sort of Borges territory here, aren't we? With this idea that a critical reading that did, the only critical reading that didn't fail would be one that just reproduced the text word for word. Is that what I can take from this?
Yeah. Exactly. Right. So it would be, right, the sort of Pierre Menard operation that you perform, and you've reproduced the text word for word. I mean, that's the perfect surface reading. You haven't strayed at all. You've been completely faithful, right, to the text. And that's this language of fidelity or faithfulness that sometimes comes up.
You write in your essay that, I'm going to quote you here, that disagreements about the way we read remain unresolvable as long as the status of the object is taken for granted. All of these approaches are unable to address the extent to which our methods and our objects are truly inseparable. That's a very interesting claim, because it seems to go against a certain idea of knowledge that posits the object of knowledge as something given, you know, something that precedes the critical encounter. Louis Althusser, who you mentioned earlier, he called this the empiricist conception of knowledge. Tell me more about that. Like, Althusser was interested in the objects of scientific knowledge. How do we see this empiricist conception articulated in the field of literary criticism?
It comes out of my sense that critics who are arguing about we should read the surface or no, we should read the depth, there's a disagreement not only about what we should focus on, but I mean, in this disagreement, what should we focus on? You have to construe something as the surface and something else as the depth in order to reject the depth or go do something in favor of the depth. Like, these are constructed objects. There's no set rule that says what counts as the surface of the text or what counts as the depth of the text. And I think that these arguments are actually masking the fact that a literary work is not something given. We don't know what the borders or boundaries are. We don't know what a context is. We actually have to construct those things. So when we do a reading of a literary text, we actually construct the object of our reading. It's not the words on the page. It's what counts as relevant to a given reading, just as the context isn't given, historical context or social context. Those things have to be constructed. We have to kind of choose what's relevant and what's not relevant. And we have to make an argument for that. So I do look at Louis Althusser, who has this sort of, it's a counterintuitive notion, but it's a notion of how science works and how knowledge works. And the idea that the object of a knowledge is not an empirical object given to the senses that we just have to look at correctly, but that science and knowledge are constructive practices, that they actually construct the very thing that they are trying to know.
You're very careful in your argument here, though. You say that you propose that what we call a work does not precede its encounter with readers and critics. In other words, there is no work in itself. Rather, the work is constituted in and through practices of reading and criticism. You're very careful about that word constituted there. What do you mean by that?
I do mean we have to determine the boundaries of it. That, again, we're not just reading the words on the page. We have to read the meaning of the words, not like a hidden meaning, but in the sense that every single word has, you know, an indeterminate number of connotations and maybe alternate meanings. You have to decide which ones are relevant to have a coherent reading of a given text. We have techniques of reading. We have pedagogies of reading and interpretation. We have practices of argument and kind of evidentiary procedures. So if I want to present a reading of Proust's Remembrance of Things Past, I have to convince you of it. I have to show you what it is I see and draw certain passages or quote from the text or bring in bits of historical evidence to support my argument. So we have argumentative procedures. And the thing that they aim at is this idea of the work. That's the thing that I think multiple critics share, even if they make radically different arguments. It's like a focal point, like a vanishing point in painting, like a vanishing point that organizes the whole field of vision. That's what I mean by a work being constructed. And part of this language of saying, well, the work is constructed is also to say, hey, what we're doing as critics is not just reporting on experiences willy-nilly, reporting on our, you know, affective experience or our aesthetic experience willy-nilly, but we're following protocols and techniques of reading. And these are shared practices. And it's a material practice because it's embedded in an institution and it's done in certain ways and it's taught in certain ways. So I'm trying to also bring validity and solidity to the practice of literary criticism by saying, hey, this is a real thing, in the sense that Althusser also talked about practice, theoretical practice, as a material practice. But this practice of literary criticism as constructing its object is not the same thing as creating ex nihilo, creating from nothing. But it takes existing words, concepts, and representations and transforms them.
That's interesting because we have this idea of a work being produced through the act of criticism, but works, of course, have many critics. Like, if you think of something like Joyce's Ulysses, the subject of probably hundreds of volumes of critical interpretation, if each of those critical encounters constitutes the work, sort of determines the work as an object of knowledge, then how is the work able to be held in common by all those hundreds of critics? Like, how is there still an objectively existing entity about which critics can agree or disagree?
Yeah, I think that's a really crucial question. And that's the question that I posed to myself in my essay from New Literary History, that if criticism is constructive, then here's the problem. How do any two critics have the same work in common? And they really have to if it's going to be a project of knowledge. And again, not this sort of group share exercise. So I think a couple ways that we construct the work, but it's not creation from nothing. It's transformation of existing materials, by which I mean, existing representations, things that are historically situated. And that this constructive activity is done according to norms and conventions that are shared.
Within institutions, within certain ideas, pre-existing ideas of how language works, this sort of thing, yeah.
Yes, exactly. So you and I may see very different things in Joyce's Ulysses, but I'm going to make an argument for it. And you know what an argument is, and you can accept or refute my argument. You could see holes or contradictions in it if I make the argument badly. And so what I think the critic constructs is the ground for interpretive claims. And that ground itself is going to be indeterminate. And that's not going to be stated in the form of a sentence again, or several sentences. But it's the ground in the sense of this organizing point that is progressively determined by specific claims that we do make in the form of sentences.
But the critic is still, to quote you, the critical practice is still beholden to something that it does not produce.
Right. And I don't want to give up on that idea. And that's what I'm calling reading, this, that there is something in the critical practice that is going to be the necessary failure of that practice, that is going to be the, that's going to show where the errors are, that's going to show that there is what Althusser called a surprise, that there is something unforeseen, or what maybe Gilles Deleuze calls an encounter, that there is the encounter with something that a critic did not invent. And the only way that we know that it's there is that there are failures or gaps in the critical discourse. I mean, another thing I've been thinking about, and I don't bring this up in the recent essay that I wrote, but just the material conditions that these arguments are coming out of. And in the US, the material conditions are just a radically and rapid defunding of the humanities. I think some of the arguments about surface reading or about having positive affects as readers comes out of a fear of losing undergraduates. And at least in my institution, if we do not have undergrads in the classroom, our majors are canceled. Like the French major at Miami has been canceled. And the reason given is that we don't have enough undergrads in the classroom, whether or not that's true. But that's the reason given. And I think so that in the US, there's a lot of anxiety over attracting undergrads to the profession and just the shrinking size of English departments and language departments. And a lot of the debates about method are a kind of turning inward. And the turning inward is partly prompted by these material circumstances that are scary.
Audrey Wasser, she's an assistant professor in the Department of French, Italian, and Classical Studies at Miami University in Ohio. And she's also the author of Empiricism, Criticism, and the Object of Criticism, which was published in the journal New Literary History. More information on the Philosopher's Zone website. And as always, you can stream or download past Philosopher's Zone conversations via ABC Listen. This episode was produced by me, David Rutledge, on Bundjalung Land. It's been a pleasure to have you along this week, and I'll look forward to your company again very soon. Bye for now.